09-2168. Thank Paul Murphy and Jeremy Kinney for Capitol Studio and Executive Council Appellate. Mrs. Gensler, please. Mrs. Lady, the appellate, move back to the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, Ted Siletis for Capitol Sprinkler Inspectors. Your Honors, today we're here really out of a matter of equal treatment of parties before the Court. Now, make no mistake, this case may ultimately turn into one where future generations look to determine what the District of Columbia Circuit will permit as far as gamesmanship among the parties during a trial or during trial court proceedings. But on the surface, at least, there seems to be several inconsistent rulings that warrant remand to the district court. Initially, I'd like to address really quickly the jurisdictional issues raised by the appellee. That is best described as a red herring. This was a matter that was submitted from final judgments as found by the district court. This court was very clear to note that there were final judgments in this case. The only reason she chose not to certify it when we put it before the judge was because there was just reason for delay. There were remaining claims with the plaintiff.
I thought she denied your 54B motion.
She did, and she denied it on the basis of just reason for delay. She made a very specific—
Because of the intertwined nature.
Because of the intertwined nature and the fact that the claims between the plaintiff below and Capitol Sprinkler still existed.
Right.
When notified.
So, at the time you filed your notice of appeal,
those claims had been fully settled. There was
executed. Could I finish my sentence?
I'm sorry?
Could I finish my sentence?
Certainly.
At the time you filed the notice of appeal, you knew that the summary judgment, which you wanted to appeal, was not appealable. Is that not correct?
No, it's not correct, Your Honor, and the reason is simple. At the time we filed the notice of appeal, the reasons for the court's ruling to deny the certification had been resolved. All claims between plaintiff and Capitol Sprinkler were settled. There was an executed settlement agreement in place.
Is that in the record anywhere?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's actually in the transcript.
Executed.
I'm sorry?
There's an executed settlement agreement. The district court said something along the lines of that the court had been advised there was a settlement in principle.
Absolutely. And, Your Honor, that
well,
was...
Can't be absolutely the answer to both questions.
Well, the district court
filed
said
on
that.
The 16th, correct?
Correct.
And on the same day, there was a letter submitted by St. Paul and the Capitol saying settlement was in process and would be resolved in the near future.
That it would be finalized within 30 days, I think was the language we used.
And the judge entered an order conditionally dismissing it without prejudice to become prejudicial if nothing else happened by the 26th.
You're right.
And on the 23rd, there was another letter saying here's a final settlement.
Certainly. The, right? the important
well, you didn't
issue
wait
was
till
the
then.
I'm sorry?
You didn't wait till then to file a notice of appeal. You'd already filed your notice of appeal on the 16th when all you had was a letter from the parties, all the judge had, was a letter from the parties saying settlement was in sight.
And that's what triggered the court's call. The court had a question, well, is this a settlement in principle? Is this a settlement? And we advised the court that plaintiff had signed the release, that we were simply waiting to tender a signed release and settlement agreement to the plaintiff together with a check.
What made you think that you could appeal simply because there was now an imminent settlement, but there was no settlement?
Because at that point, we had an enforceable settlement agreement with the plaintiff that resolved all claims which were the subject of the court's denial.
Is that document in the record?
I believe
or is there testimony to that effect in the record?
Yes, the court's transcript of...
I understood that the district court said that, I'm going to say it again, had been advised there was a settlement in principle. Is that wrong?
The court advised that it was a settlement in principle, but, Your Honor, I
led
the question.
The court was told that there was a settlement in principle.
That's exactly what the court said, and that's exactly what appears in the court order.
That's not what you think is the case.
No,
show me in the record what,
certainly.
What establishes what you want to say.
The... I believe it's the transcripts. I believe there may actually be a certification of counsel or an affidavit of counsel to the effect of the statements made during the conference with the court, because the court did not record that.
I'm only looking for a JA page.
Here's the docket entry. The judge says, on October 16, plaintiff and defendant Capital Sprinkler Inspection informed the court in a telephonic conversation that they had reached a settlement in principle.
That's what I was referring to.
Right.
Do you have something better than that? That is more firm than that.
That's the record, unless you've got something specifically that contradicts it.
Absolutely. On page JA-600, notice of settlement. This is to advise that plaintiff and Capital Sprinkler have settled all claims between them. As such, the party will not be filing a joint pretrial statement or motions in limine as to all claims. It notes very clearly that it does not affect the matters before this court on appeal, and that we would be finalizing the settlement agreement and filing the joint stip within the 30 days.
Is that before or after you filed the notice of appeal?
This was filed before the notice of appeal.
This notice of settlement was?
Yes.
How do we know that?
The docket indicator number, 95.
Right.
The notice of appeal is number 96. And what happened
and
is the court
is
had a reasonable question.
Is docket number 5 where it says entered in error? Something like that.
Yes, apparently the it was interesting. The court clerk advised us that filing the letter was insufficient. We had to actually file a cover sheet with the caption with the letter attached. So that's what we did.
So your point is that in the district court, the October 16th notice of settlement was filed.
Yes.
At time one.
Yes.
And at time two, you filed your notice of appeal.
Correct.
But you had not yet filed a stipulation of dismissal.
Correct.
So the best argument you can make is that you reasonably thought you had something final, not that you actually had something final. Is that right?
Well, I can tell you that if the plaintiff had reneged, we'd be back in the district court on an enforcement action.
Well, your own letter says within the next 30 days, the plaintiff and Capital Sprinkler will finalize a settlement agreement.
Correct, and that was the exact point of the court's call. And when we explained that, well, St. Paul had already signed the agreement, it had been tendered to Capital's executives who had at that time had actually signed it and dropped it in the mail to return to us to tender to St. Paul together with the check, which at that point we had. It's final.
Assume for the moment that you lose on the question of whether it was final. You want to go on to your outlaw argument and your Rule 4 argument.
Well, that's the interesting thing. Let's assume that it was not final at that point. Moving forward, outlaw requires that simply at some point in time before we appear before the court, a final settlement or a final order has been entered dismissing all outstanding claims. In fact, that occurred before the 23rd, a final dismissal with prejudice. And in fact, at least in the District of Columbia, the fact that the court dismissed the court without dismissed the case without prejudice is sufficient to do away with all cases or all matters before the court. I believe the quote is to the effect of, it doesn't matter if it's with or without prejudice. A dismissal to the effect of all claims in the court disposes of the matter before the court. This was certainly a matter that came to this court on appeal after a final judgment had been entered. Now, whether the notice of dismissal was premature or whether it was timely, it was certainly filed within 10 days after the decision on the motion for certification, as required by the rule. That's when the time starts ticking. And it certainly was filed in anticipation of a ruling from the court dismissing all matters with prejudice. Ultimately, Rule 4 is intended to mature prematurely filed notices, and I submit that this is specifically the kind of premature activity, if it in fact it was, that the rule contemplates.
Let me ask you about the district court's order of October 16th. That's it. JA 603?
Yes.
That's where the district court recites that a settlement in principle has been reached.
Correct.
And she says this case is dismissed without prejudice until the 26th. Suppose... In other words, is your reading of that order that the case would be over on the 26th regardless of
yes.
what happened?
Yes.
Unless you acted.
Unless some party took an act to set aside the court's judgment, mm-hmm. to set aside the order dismissing the case without prejudice. Getting into the substance of the appeal.
Before you do, just a moment.
Yes, sir. Your Honor.
The other side of this case has, I believe, invoked the... no, I guess not. I was thinking of the Robinson-Reeder case.
Actually, that was our case.
It was your case.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what's the significance of that?
Robinson-Reeder is... simply for the premise that the court or the rule is intended to mature premature filings, whether it be a premature filing that results in a dismissal without prejudice or one that was filed post-dismissal without prejudice. If it's premature and the court ultimately enters an order that disposes of the entire case with prejudice prior to appearing for this appeal, then the appeal is timely and the court can hear it. The court has jurisdiction to hear it. One of the interesting things is when the court was advised that the settlement had been reached, one would presume that the more appropriate act might have been to amend or revise the court's order denying certification, rather than enter an order dismissing without prejudice. Because in denying revising the order denied certification, the court can address the specific facts that all claims had been resolved, and thus the reason that there was no just reason for delay before is no longer present.
I had understood Robinson-Reeder to say, I think this is the opposite of what you said, I'm not sure, that a premature notice of appeal cannot ripen unless there is a court order.
Prior to the hearing, and there is. Prior to today's oral argument, the district court had entered, I believe it's docket indicator number 98, possibly number, 101. It was an order dismissing the matter with prejudice. So that actually occurred. And as long as that has occurred, then the appeal is ripe for consideration by this court.
You're implying that could occur at any time prior to oral argument here?
Yeah, it was prior to argument before the court. I presume that referred to oral argument.
That's not from Robinson-Reeder. That part, if there's a part to it, is from Outlaw. All the Robinson-Reeder held is that if it's dismissed with prejudice, if a case is dismissed with prejudice, it's a final appealable case. Your problem is that you appealed before
right.
that order was entered. That now throws us into the outlaw question.
That's right.
Which we still argue falls in our favor.
I understand. That's why I asked you to go on, and you went on. So I think maybe merits would be a good time here.
Okay.
On the merits, we have submitted five arguments. Admittedly, the questions of summary judgment are somewhat related. Our initial argument was on denial of Capital's motion for supplement its expert disclosure. And really, the focus of that argument is one simple thing, whether Capital had just reason or had good cause to delay the submission of the supplement. And in this case, Capital had attempted to take two depositions, was originally under the understanding that the plaintiff was going to do so. The plaintiff withdrew their notice of deposition, so Capital began discussions to take the depositions. Each time, Capital was advised by guests that they would assist, that they would see what they could find. Certainly, they provided last known addresses for the individuals. But what was failed to disclose to Capital, and what Capital only discovered after the close of discovery and after employing a private detective to try to find these individuals, was that one of them was dead 9 months before the initial disclosure saying he was a guest employee was filed. When raised to the court, the court quite literally brushed that aside and looked to, well, why did you wait so long? Why didn't you file a motion? And the reason was very simple. We believe we were working towards a common end. At that point in time, we have letters, we have emails reflecting a spirit of cooperation. So the question in Capital's mind would be, how would a motion to compel filed in the middle of the holiday season when the only evidence of record is emails and letters indicating that the deponent's counsel are willing to assist, be treated by the court who said, don't bring these issues to us until you've tried to work it out yourself? So as far as whether Capital had good cause to seek the supplementation and delay in the disclosure of the experts or in the supplementation of its expert disclosure, we believe that was wholeheartedly in response to or derived from Capital's reliance on representations made to it prior to the hearing for the court in February.
Made to it by?
Guest counsel and guest services. And this is granted on the presumption that counsel was actually working with guest services to secure at least the location, identity, that some assistance, as the letters indicated they would provide. It appears that counsel now argues that, well, they were under no such duty to provide that assistance. But where the offer was made and reliance was placed upon it, it seems now is not the time to argue, well, we really didn't need to do that.
And our standard of review is abuse of discretion by the district court, correct?
Correct. And the district court knew and came to realize that Capital had been strung along, so to speak.
Well, they obviously didn't come to realize it enough, or they would have, the district court would have given you more time.
Well, we anticipated the district court came to realize
in
that.
And the district court said,
in the end, the district court said, no, there was no good cause. Capital simply should have filed motions or supplemented its expert disclosure before the appropriate deadline. Importantly, the court made very specific note that it was not striking Capital's expert disclosure and would not do so unless one of the parties filed a motion to strike and supported it with sufficient memorandum of law and evidence. That never occurred in this case. In this case, Capital's expert disclosure at this time stands. Yet, the thrust of Guest's argument is that Capital has no expert.
That was the thrust of the district court's decision.
Yes, it was. And that question was never before the district court.
Judge Rogers, want to hear more on the merits?
I don't think so.
Okay. You've used your time, counsel. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May May it please the court, my name is Steve Horvath and I represent Guest Services. I would like to address the first issue, and that is the issue of this court's jurisdiction to hear the appeal, and want to address some of the specific issues in this case because I think it's very important to get the appropriate timeline and what happened here. It's not disputed that the appellant has the burden of proving that the court has jurisdiction. It's also undisputed that this is an Article III court, and it's undisputed the fact that if you file a notice of appeal, that in theory divests the district court of jurisdiction, that the function of a notice of appeal is to divest the district court, so then the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction. Even though they filed this notice of appeal, they continued to anticipate that there would be further and additional filings in the district court.
The same thing happened in Outlaw, so you have to distinguish Outlaw.
I would distinguish Outlaw for a couple of reasons. First, in Outlaw, the court suggested that since there could have been a Rule 54B motion, and there was not, the court would at that time consider this as if it was a 54B issue. That's my reading of Outlaw. Further, if under the argument that's being made by the appellant, the Rule 4A2 that says that the time, if the court announces a decision, and before there's an order entered on that announced decision, you notice an appeal, then under those circumstances, the court will say, okay, even though it's premature, we'll come back and get it. I don't think Outlaw eviscerates that completely because under the argument that is being made here, it's not dealing with an announced decision.
It's dealing with the summary judgment. That was an announced decision.
That's correct.
And in Outlaw, seems identical. There was a summary judgment. That's what Outlaw was dealing with. The problem in Outlaw was that there was still another party left. The problem here is that there was still another party left. And the court in Outlaw and the district court in Outlaw continued with that other party, just like the court here continued with that other party. So how do you distinguish them?
I'll make a couple of distinctions. First, in that case, what it was going to arbitration. And the only reason why the court still had the case open on its docket was pending a decision from the arbitration.
And then the arbitration was stayed.
And the arbitration.
In Outlaw, yeah.
And then the court, then the notice was filed, and then they went forward and appealed the case. The second way I'd like to distinguish Outlaw is the Robinson-Reeder case, which they've cited. Because in Robinson-Reeder, I believe, if I read this court's correctly, the court says essentially, we're not going to let the parties filing stipulations affect the jurisdiction of the court and the ability to move forward.
That goes to the first question of whether this was final at the time they appealed.
Right.
Assume that you've won on that point, that it was not final for just the reason you gave. You don't have any doubt that at the end, where there is a dismissal with prejudice by the court, that this case is now final, right? You don't have a doubt about that.
I have no doubt the case was final after that was entered. Right. There's no question about that.
So I'm not sure how Robinson-Reeder doesn't really, assuming, as I think I'm asking you to, that you won on the point, on the first half of the point, I'm not sure where Robinson-Reeder plays in at all.
Well, the purpose of Robinson-Reeder is that Robinson-Reeder says we're not going to let the party stipulation act as the basis for getting the jurisdiction. Because the function of Rule 4A2, you have to give some meaning to that term.
That gets you to the point that it wasn't final at the time they appealed.
And then you say the saving grace of 4A2.
That's the question.
Is because you have an announced decision, and the court later is going to enter an order based on that announced decision. Here we didn't have an announced decision
but
on that.
The announced decision is the summary judgment order. That was a decision of the court.
That's true, but that was not final until everything is gone, until the entire case is gone.
That was the same in Outlaw.
There's no question about that. But if you look at the reasoning, the way I read Outlaw, it talks about Rule 54B, and there could have been a Rule 54B motion that was made, and as a result of that, that will give you the extending time. Here we had a 54B motion, which was denied. So that one key element in Outlaw was that there was no 54B motion that had been filed. The court could have done this on a 54B motion. There was no reason for it to go up on a 54B motion because all the circumstances were there.
Well, let me ask you. Outlaw, of course, was bound by first tier. And first tier talks about Rule 4A2 as not excusing all kinds of situations. And it says whether or not there was a reasonable ground to believe that an order was not final. And so the distinction, arguably, with outlaw is that here you had, as you were just saying to Judge Garland, the denial of a 54B motion so that no reasonable party could believe at that point that the district court thought that the summary judgment to Guest was a final appealable order.
Your Honor stated much more articulately than I wanted to state it, so thank you. Yes, that's exactly my point, that since there was a 54B ruling saying we cannot appeal this, that's distinguished from outlaw in that regard. And the only thing we had then was we will be entering the stipulation sometime in the future. There could be no question that they knew that this was not an appealable order because they had a ruling saying you cannot appeal it, unlike in outlaw where there was no such ruling saying you cannot appeal it.
But on outlaw, it's clear that the case is, the argument about 54B is purely hypothetical because, of course, there hadn't been either a motion or an order. And the court is just interpreting the Supreme Court statement that when a notice of appeal sought review of a non-final decision that would be appealable if immediately followed by the entry of judgment. And that's still the case here. It would be appealable if there had been an entry of judgment. There wasn't. In fact, there was a denial. But it still fits within the argument that it would be appealable if there had been. And in the end, there is one, of course. In the end, there's the other. So it's not, I mean, outlaw doesn't address the question of what happens when you have a 54B motion denied. But the force of outlaw is purely hypothetical. It doesn't seem to matter to outlaw whether there was or wasn't.
But the if you go back to outlaw and the purpose of it, the whole purpose of this, as the court is, the Supreme Court has stated, is to deal with that situation where you're not quite sure if you can appeal it right now. That's the whole purpose of it. If you look at the language, it says it's to take care of those attorneys or counsel is not really knowledgeable about the situation. They're caught between, basically caught between a rock and a hard place. That's what their feeling is.
The denial of 54B, that occurred before they submitted the settlement, right?
That's correct.
So an outlaw isn't about somebody thinking that, oh, maybe we could have won a Rule 54B if we'd only filed it and the court had only ordered. That would be crazy because they hadn't filed it, so they couldn't have thought they were going to win it. Outlaw is about whether it's reasonable but an error to think that you can appeal at this point. Their argument here is it's reasonable, although in error, because they submitted what they claim is a final settlement in advance.
Well, I would submit that that's not quite the case because here what they say is that we will file a stipulation of dismissal in the future. We will. So they know it's not dismissed at that point in time. There's no question they don't think this notice is a final order because it says, quote, counsel will thereafter once it is finalized. So we're not dealing with a situation where it's just simply a mistake.
Is there any case, you could read outlaw as saying we're going to, you know, in the future look and ask whether mistakes are reasonable, but that's not what they did in outlaw. In outlaw, they just applied a rule. If it would be final, if an order were issued later, that's the end of it. It would be opening up quite a door of difficulty for us if instead the rule were not just that, but the rule were actually, we have to decide in each case what's reasonable. And a number of circuits have followed outlaw. Has any court ruled that an appeal is no good because it was unreasonable to think it was final, as compared to the argument that it couldn't have been final?
There are, I don't recall seeing, I read them last night, and I was looking through it to see, I know there's some distinguishing thing, but there's nothing that really addressed this situation that we find ourselves in. And I would propose that the easiest way to address it is to not make outlaw as broad as the appellant is arguing, because under the appellant's argument, it eviscerates the whole requirement of 4A2. Under the appellant's argument, so long as at any time there's a final order before oral argument, I guess, then the appeal is not premature.
That's what we said in Outlaw. That's, I mean, you wouldn't have this argument if they hadn't made a 54B motion at all, right? Then you'd be exactly an outlaw, right?
I would have a problem. I would concede I would have a problem under Outlaw.
So Outlaw does say we don't want to go any further, but that's a reference to the parts of first tier in which the court said there are pure interlocutory things like discovery, and we're not trying to reach that.
But again, we have to give, and I would suggest the court should look at Outlaw and look at it in Robinson Reeder. And say, what is the purpose of 4A2? You have to give some meaning to that language and an announced decision and then appeal thereafter to take care of that gap situation between the rock and the hard place. And here we have a situation where we don't have, there's pure knowledge that they cannot appeal it. They know it's premature because they say we are going to file something in the future. The judge says it is settlement in principle. It's not a final settlement. If it had been a final settlement, then they could have done the stipulation of dismissal at that point in time. But it wasn't a final settlement. If there's still acts that have to be take place, why did they do it? And the rule is that if you file your notice of appeal, the court is divested of jurisdiction, but they continue to act in that court as if that court had jurisdiction. So we have all these situations. I would suggest that the way to do it is to reconcile Robinson Reeder and Outlaw and suggest that you can reconcile it by limiting the decision to where you have an announced decision and then there's a ruling on it. And the one exception we have in Outlaw is the 54B, which we don't have here. And that's why I would suggest it can be handled and you can reconcile those two cases. To address the merits of this, first of all, counsel says that there, on the expert disclosure, there was counsel was not actually trial counsel down below, but he says there was repeated efforts that we misled them on regular occasions, that we told them we're going to get witnesses available and we did not. There's nothing in the record to that effect. The only thing we have in the record is there was a request for the last known address from Mr. Hamm and his phone number, and we responded. We have no idea what his phone number is. This is his last known address. That's all we had. Second thing they asked for is they say, we want the information for Mr. Terrence Hubbard. Well, unbeknownst to us, Mr. Hubbard had passed away 9 months before the lawsuit was filed. They claim that as prejudice because they weren't able to take his deposition. I'm at a loss as to how you can be prejudiced if the person is already dead. I mean, he would never be able to take his deposition. The third point on that is that their expert did file a disclosure, although it was woefully inadequate, without the depositions. They didn't need it for that finding. And for that reason, I think that's just a complete red herring. It's an abuse of discretion. On the issue of summary judgment, they complain the fact that...
You mean to say it's not an abuse of discretion?
It's not an abuse of discretion. On the issue of summary judgment, you have to keep in mind that there was a plaintiff and guest services, and we were aligned 100% together. In fact, if you look at the statement of undisputed facts for their motion for summary judgment, they're word for word, number for number, line for line the same. And actually, to the point that when I was reviewing the joint appendix, I didn't realize that they had put the wrong one in because they're identical. Between my client, guest services, and St. Paul. And so there was a dispute of each one of those facts before the court. The court had that in front of the record. And the real issue they came down to in this case was the plaintiff going to be able to prove what the standard was, or that there was a standard that was applicable, contrary to a written contract, that applied for making the access point readily accessible. And the answer to that was they didn't have anything. They admit they didn't have anything. They didn't have anyone to talk about what that meant. Even their expert designation did not really talk about what that meant. So we are left in a situation where they could not prove their essential only claim. And the most amazing thing to me about this entire case is that my client contracted with Capital to inspect and drain. And now we're being sued because they're saying we didn't drain. But they were hired to make that contract. And the only basis they can get around it is they have to rely on a contract that was entered into between Gallaudet and my client that they're not a party to. I would submit that this case was appropriately decided on summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Horn.
Thank you.
Give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. There are a few cases or a few points I'd like to make in rebuttal. I think the issue of jurisdiction has been well discussed. As to the substance, initially, please note that Capital's motion for summary judgment was not opposed. Guest failed to timely oppose the motions for summary judgment. The court, in its scheduling and procedures order, noted that consistent with the court's rules, but more strictly construing them than may otherwise have been its option, the court will deem that an unopposed statement of facts is in fact decisive, is that the court will deem that those facts are admitted by the non-movement. Now here, the court ruled against Capital despite its prior order. As to Guest's motion for summary judgment, very interestingly, Guest was in fact sued not because it didn't rain, but because it didn't give access. Capital showed up, and when they got to the room where the subject drip was, it was locked. And this has turned into a case of, well, can a jury determine whether a locked door provides access? And I'll say any juror that would sit, if they lock their keys in their car, they're going to think they don't have access to the inside of their car. If Capital was locked out of the building, there can be no question Capital didn't have access to the drains to drum them. But here, because Capital was locked out of a specific room, the issue of, well, did Capital have access to that room becomes a question of, was it reasonable to ask the person who was appointed by the building's engineer to do the work himself versus asking the person to go down and hopefully find a key at the front desk? That is a question for a jury, not a judge. Whether or not the decision to ask one thing versus another, that is clearly a question for the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Sinclair.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you both.